Okay, let's get started, everybody. Welcome to our very first official event of the ExoStar 19KHP program. I'm really excited to have you here. My name is Dan Huber from the University of Hawaii. And
Jim Buller from Caltech. We're the only two organizers here thus far.
Expect the rest for the next 2 weeks.
Yeah, we'll be joined by Kata and Rebecca back in a couple of weeks.
Yes, that's right. So I prepared a couple of slides. This is the first meeting about the motivation of the program, or sort of what motivated us as coordinators to actually propose this program. First, a couple of pictures of the coordinators. Jim and I are here. Becky and Katya are going to join later. Victor, I was supposed to be here this week, but unfortunately he won't be able to come, at least not for as long as he wanted to, because of other obligations that you see in this photo. He's training the next synergistic. That's his priority for now. So the real motivation, and I think the way it initially started was that Victor and I had a conversation many years ago about how meetings in solar astrophysics and exoplanet science sort of ran in parallel for quite a long time. Both of these fields had a lot of very exciting results over the last two decades, but here's just some examples of meetings that many of you will be familiar with. Meeting series, right, that are focused on exoplanet science and on stars. So there's extreme solar systems this year. It's a very famous series that goes on every few years. There's the exoplanet series now. It used to be protostars and planets. I think that's only every 6 years. And then, of course, for the star side, so this is for the exoplanet science, and for the star side, cool stars is the very famous series that has been going on. And it was just last year, sort of all over the last year. Should I be speaking into a microphone? The point is that we thought the two communities have had conferences for a long time that ran in parallel, and it's really, it would be really good to have a venue where the two intersect, where solar astrophysicists and people that really care about exoplanets
come together to talk about joint problems or wishes, what they want to see addressed, things that they would like to see solved or that have been wondering about. And so far, in fact, as far as I remember, the only times this has happened serendipitously were things like the Kepler Science Conference, because Kepler did exoplanet science, but also a lot of other science at the same time. So this is the poster that I found for the very first Kepler Science Conference. And if you look at the bullet points, the first six of them are, first five of them are exoplanets, and then the rest at the bottom is essentially astroseismology and some stellar science. And in fact, the conference was organized this way. The first 3 days was mostly on exoplanets, and then the last 2 days was stellar science. And essentially what happened is that after the first 3 days, the exoplanet community left, and then it was mostly the stellar people left over. So we wanted to have a KHP program where the two communities come together with a purpose, and that's essentially what motivated this meeting, or the idea for having ExoStar 19. We're not the first ones, of course, and this has happened before, and it's getting more and more in the calendar in terms of conferences and meetings. A couple of years ago now, we had No Thy Star, No Thy Planet, organized by NEXI, and there are other initiatives. This year, in fact, at Ringberg, MPIA, Maria Bergerman and others are also organizing a dedicated conference to bring together the communities. But that's essentially the main motivation, without going too much into the science, which we'll do now. During the introduction phase as to why we wanted to have this program here at KHP. And we're very grateful that they gave us the opportunity to do it. So a couple of logistics before we go into the introductions. We're going to use Slack for logistics in terms of organizing projects and collaborations. Those of you who have been here before, there used to be wikis at KHP. Those have been discontinued as far as I know. So this is going to be our main way of keeping track of what's going on, what people are working on. So if you haven't used it before, please take the opportunity to sign up. It's actually a pretty good tool. There's lots of good apps, whatever platform you're using. It's good support, and you can see, in fact, we already have some organization of the barbecue going on for tomorrow with Dan from Mackie. So I think it's going to be very useful. If you haven't used it before, then hopefully this program will be a good starting point to start using it. Okay, these are just the events. You have this in your email. I don't think I need to spend time on this. We'll have two talks this week. So Johanna tomorrow is going to start us off with exoplanet results from TESS. And then Aldo later this week on Thursday will tell us about stellar models. uncertainties and limitations and everything that exoplanet scientists will need to know about stellar models. And then in between, I guess one thing I want to say is that for the program is not really fixed in, as I said, in stone beyond this week. So I've said this to some of you already. Do you have any ideas of what you think works well based on previous experience or anything that you would like to see, please let us know. So in particular on Wednesday, I think Jimmy can talk a little bit about what the Wednesday meeting will be. But typically, I think it's pretty open.
So this week, I think one thing we want to do is brainstorm different working groups we want to develop. But for the future, we don't have our Wednesday meetings totally mapped out. So that's maybe something we can discuss at the end of today is, you know, any ideas we want to do as a group or as subgroups on this day.
Yeah, the goal is to have something going on, I think, each day that's sort of scheduled where people come together. But the format itself doesn't have to be fixed. On Friday, we have the idea that we've had, and we see how well it works, is to have sort of a bring a plot session. So anything you've worked on during the week, upload a plot and talk about it very informally with the group and get input into, you know, any obstacles you run into, any feedback you want to get on particular research that you've done. So that will be in a similar format, I guess, as this meeting here. Whereas today is sort of what do I want to get out? What's my background? And Friday is what have I done? What's the current status? Okay. So with that, I think it's good to move on to the introduction slides because we do have, obviously, because it's our first week, quite a few people here. So we'll probably won't have as much time as the Gaia program for each person to do the introductions because we have like 11 slides on here. And even if you're here and you didn't upload a slide, then of course you can still talk about your interests. I guess we'll do that most at the end. Okay, so just as a background, this is going to be sort of introduce yourself, the research interests, what you're interested in working on while you're here, but also mention something outside of astronomy. So we've been encouraged, obviously, a lot of us are here for a long time, so if you have any hobbies that might connect with others, then this is a good time to name them and find connections with people that might be interested in the same thing. Okay, so I'll start. My interests in terms of the science research that I've done is astroseismology, mostly of cool stars, so main sequence stars and red giants. I'm involved very heavily in the test mission, the astroseismology side of the test missions. I'm chairing one of the working groups that does astroseismology of exoplanet host stars, so to characterize the star better using astroseismology and hence the transiting planet. Very related to this, I've been getting interested in the last few years in branching out, not just using astroseismology, but any tool that you can find to characterize the population of exoplanet transit surveys, such as TESS and Kepler. Obviously, that has been a lot getting a lot easier with Gaia, so that's going to be one of my main interests also here, is to exploit the Gaia data further to characterize exoplanet host stars. And I've also done quite a bit of work with optical long-based line interferometry using the CHAR array. In fact, we have an observing run starting tonight on CHAR to measure angular diameters of stars and pin down fundamental properties of stars, such as effective temperatures. So the plots that are here show one piece of work that's already been finished. It was done by my graduate student, Travis Berger. This is on the left, showing the radius distribution of Kepler exoplanets as a function of incident flux. And there are a few features in this distribution that have gained a lot of interest in the community. The gap, for example, for small planets that you see here. And we're interested in redoing this for K2. So you can just, what we've done is we used Gaia parallaxes combined with effective temperatures to get radii, prove the radii of the planets. And I'm really interested in mapping this into the K2 sample. K2 has also found lots of planets, and we can redo this essentially for the K2 population. And it's interesting because K2 observed different stars than Kepler, more low-mass stars, a lot of K and M dwarfs. And we're interested to see how these structures, structures and these gaps, which we believe at least partially are caused by photoevaporation, map as a function of stellar properties. And the differences that we see on the right, which is some preliminary work I've done a few months ago, and I'm eager to pursue while I'm here. This is the K2 sample on the right to sort of see the differences in terms of the stellar properties and what that does to the radius incident flux distribution. I'm also interested in working more on this code called ISO Classifier that I've been sort of developing over the last half year or so. It's essentially just a generic isochrone fitting code that takes any sort of input observables, parallaxes, colors, spectroscopy, whatever you throw at it, and does a probabilistic inference of stellar parameters using a grid of isochrones. And I'm interested in comparing this to what other people have used and improving it, take more input parameters, make it better in various different ways. Okay.
Where are your social life?
Oh, yes. My social, yeah, that's right. Okay, so So I enjoy surfing. I'm very scared of the water temperature here, but I surf and I'm determined to go surfing while I'm here. So anyone who's interested in joining me in that endeavor, let me know. Okay, any questions? Yes.
In the plot, well, in both plots, but especially the one on the left, which is Kepler, is that what you're saying? Is that all the Kepler stars or specific effective temperature cups?
This is the entire planet. Sample, yes. The colors are distinguishing the confirmed planets versus the candidates, of which there are actually still quite a lot, which is another interesting aspect. There's still a lot of candidate planets, even you know after the Kepler mission has concluded. But yeah, so the colors are just confirmed versus candidate, the same on the right. But those are all the planets. The right-hand one, I'm sure, is outdated. I made that plot 6 months ago, so I'm pretty sure there have been more K2 planets that have been found.
Are there any features we should be noticing other than the photo evaporation valley?
So there are a couple that we point out. So the photo evaporation valley is this. Well, actually, the terminology of this is a bit not agreed on, I would say. So this is what's commonly called the photo evaporation valley. This has been pointed out as the hot super Earth desert, which has been pointed to as the same mechanism, photo evaporation, but at a different incident flux regime. You can see that it's not empty, right? So if you make this plot using only a very small sample of stars, we think you know the parameters really well from seismology, it is empty. If you take a larger sample where you have Gaia-determined radii, it's somewhat populated. And the box here, which was defined in a paper by Mia Lundquist, essentially just saying, you know, empirically, where is the parameter space where we don't see planets? It's the same in both of these plots. And one perhaps interesting question is, does the border here, what is under density, let's call it that way, where desert starts, is that shift that you see from the Kepler sample to the K2 sample real? Because the K2 sample, the parent sample, the stars, are lower mass, and hence the XUV flux that the planets experience as a function of time is different because you're looking at K and M dwarfs rather than mostly solar type stars. And if that's related to the photo evaporation, then that might be one. Other than that, the obvious thing that's often pointed out is this trend where you have hot Jupiter inflation as a function of incident flux, which comes out in the Kepler sample. So the higher the incident flux, the larger the inflation of the radii of Jupiter is. We don't see that in the K2 sample yet, because, again, that's a fairly old sample there, so it might come out better. Okay.
Okay, so I think the way we'll do this, we'll just go through the slides, and when your slide comes up, you can come up and speak about yourself. I'm Jim Fuller. I'm an assistant professor at Caltech. I'm a theorist with pretty broad interests, so I've worked on many things, astroseismology, binary stars, tidal interactions, planetary structure. I'm also interested in massive stars and supernovae. I'd say my main expertise is hydrodynamics and stellar interiors and stellar structure, but some applications of that are things like tidal interactions and astroseismology. Let's see, something I'm really interested in working on here is understanding a bit more how tidal interactions shape short-period exoplanetary systems. So these dynamics are not very well understood and can be quite complex. So for instance, you can have planets born at short orbital periods that migrate out at first, stars spinning faster than the planets orbiting, and then the star spins down, and then it's spinning slower, and so then the planet can migrate back in tidally. And this all depends on the stellar type and how fast it spins down and how fast the tidal interactions work. So I think there's a lot of really intricate and interesting dynamics there. Interested in learning about here, but lots of other things as well. Let's see, so social activities. I like running, playing ultimate frisbee, and climbing. Surfing too, although I have surfed here, it's definitely gonna be chilly. So if anybody's interested in forming little groups to do any of those things, let me know.
Let's see. You can rent you a wetsuit.
Yeah, I would definitely recommend wetsuits. Sure.
So we can always go back and ask questions later, right? Yeah. Once we know who we're talking to.
Sounds good.
Okay, Dimitri.
I'm not sure if this actually does anything. I really don't. Hi, everybody. My name is Dimitri Veras, and although I study various aspects of exoplanetary systems, my primary focus is on planetary systems that are around white dwarfs and giant branch stars. And I do, when I say planetary systems, I do mean systems, not just the planets, but also the smaller bodies, the comets, the moons, and the asteroids. And the asteroids are particularly important. And I think this program is a particularly good fit for this research because the star-planet interactions in both cases are so important, and they manifest themselves in such different ways, depending on whether you're referring to white dwarfs or giant branch stars. One particularly untapped area of this science that I want to explore over the next 6 weeks while I'll be here is the actual how the different planetary components, the atmospheres, the surfaces, and the interiors change as the star traverses all the giant branch phases. This really is a part of the science that has not received that much attention, but it's crucial to determining the fate of these planetary systems. And then hobbies. So I, because I don't drive, I actually am somewhat of a public transport obsessive. And so if you want to go somewhere on a weekend, for example, then I could probably give you advice about trains or even the local Santa Barbara buses, which I've learned about.
Hello, I'm Pierre Maxhead from Keele University in the UK. So I put up a plot here which shows some very small error bars compared to some theoretical models. And this is essentially my interest, is in producing those very small error bars. This is an old trick, you know, people have been doing this for years, but I think this is something that really needs to be looked at again, because I think this is a useful place to come and talk about this, because I think there's not an appreciation yet amongst the theoretical community about what can be done with binary stars. With the data that are now available, it's completely changed the picture. It used to be the case that there was a fairly limited number of binary stars and people would go and study their favorite ones, they'd get the parameters, they'd put them out there for the theorists to use. That's not going to work anymore. We have thousands and thousands of eclipsing binaries, and they're sampling areas of parameter space in terms of their period and the types of stars that which hardly exist in the existing catalogs. And it's really what we can now do instead is try to figure out, and I'd like to talk to people about this, what type of binary system will answer the astrophysical question that you're interested in, and then to do beforehand the calculation of how precisely do we need to know those masses, because we can give you masses to 0.01% if you want. That's just a matter of telescope time. And if you've got space-based photometry and total eclipses, you can get masses down at the 0.1, 0.2% level. We can also now get very precise temperatures, and that's something I'm working on now, is just how precise are those temperatures going to be with Gaia parallaxes. And those are model-independent temperatures. Those are really TF from L equals 4 pi r squared sigma t to the fourth. These are not temperatures from the best-fitting models. And if you've got solar type twins, you can do spectral disentangling. If it's a solar type star, you can do differential abundances. So we could be talking to abundances precise to 0.01. Okay, so essentially, where the state of eclipsing binary star studies was, say, 20 years ago, almost everything is now increased by an order of magnitude in terms of precision, and the samples are huge. So really, the question I'm really interested in for this program is, where do we start? You know, which type of system should we be working on, and how precisely do you need these masses and radii and so on? And then there's a really interesting question just from the sort of at that interface between the model and the observation, which is always where all the, a lot of interesting things happen. How we do we make the best use of the observations in terms of constraining the models? You know, can we really do full Bayesian analysis to get distributions of helium versus age versus overshooting? Is that something we should be aiming for? Is that feasible? That would be a really interesting discussion to have, I think. In terms of things I work on and in terms of hobbies, I'm easily bored and easily distracted, so this is not everything I work on, and I do most, I've tried lots of sports, but I've recently discovered my love of cycling, so we'll put that one out there. Thank you.
Hi, everybody. My name is Phil Muirhead. I'm at Boston University. I threw just a bunch of slides up here, figures from papers. I'm also very interested in binary stars. I'm interested in the mass-radius relationship for low-mass stars. Most of what I do involves M-dwarfs or smaller stars. And we've also been doing a lot of work on eclipsing binaries. That plot there on the left is a mass-radius plot with a bunch of different stars, and there's a lot of scatter, and it's sitting above models, so that's curious. And those different colored points are the same eclipsing binary star analyzed by three different groups, giving you dramatically different results. And one of those is my group, led by a student of mine. So I'm trying to figure out why we have that scatter, why it sits above the models, and I listed some possible reasons there. The fits themselves, obviously there are differences in the fits. Do you have spots suppressing flux? Mixing length theory is an approximation. Do we need to correct mixing length theory in order to account for these effects that we're seeing? Or is it a combination of all these things? So that's one area I'm interested in. The other thing I'm interested in are ages of M-dwarf stars. M-dwarf stars don't change very much over Hubble times. They do spin down, but that's more of a transition than a gradual change. And one way to get at ages is to measure abundances. So in the middle there, there's that Haywood plot. That's not my work, but that's showing titanium enhancement versus iron in nearby main sequence stars, and those colors are their ages. So you see a clear age change, and that's for nearby FGK stars, something like what Dr. Teske does next to me. So we use that on M-dwarfs to get their ages, and that's what's shown up there. We have a couple of posteriors. We did that top plot with the three different colored lines. One is a kinematic age, one is a chemical age, and we combine the two to get a true age of this particular planet host, GJ876. And then this project I'm spinning up on right now, some folks at my university were acquiring this 2-meter telescope in Arizona. We'd like to search for planets around brown dwarfs. That's kind of, we are actually acquiring the telescope, but that survey hasn't started. That's a little bit vaporware right now. But in terms of this meeting, I'm really interested in getting ages for sun-like stars to calibrate our M-dwarf method. And I'm in the company of people who understand abundances of sun-like stars and astroseismology. I'd like to see if we can improve that plot from 2013. Those are isochronal ages in the Haywood plot. It'd be great to incorporate astroseismology, something I know nothing about. And then I'm obviously interested in talking to the people who do models of the interiors of stars to try to understand this mass-radius relationship. And if there's anybody who wants to collaborate on a 2-meter telescope that I'm now acquiring, I'd be interested in talking to you. I like to go running. I did the running club this morning. It was great. So 7 o'clock, we leave. I went with the quantum folks, learned a lot. Well, I heard a lot. I'm not sure I learned. I like to cycle, so I'm going to go rent a bike maybe today or tomorrow if anybody wants to go to the bike place. And then I live in Boston. I don't own a car, but I do drive. I use Zipcar, so I have a Zipcar subscription. So if anybody wants to get away off-site, I'd be happy to rent a car. We can go maybe hike in the mountains or something like that. I can put that on the social thing.
Okay, my name is Johanna Teske. I'm a Hubble Fellow at Carnegie Observatories in Pasadena, which is a little bit warmer than it is here today. And I'm interested in, I mean, like, my whole PhD was, how are stars and planets related? So this is perfect for me. I have come at it from kind of two main angles. One is host star composition, so different, both kind of fun, the stellar parameters of stars, but then digging in further and getting different elemental compositions. I've done work on binary stars, twin stars, and getting very precise differential abundances. And then in my postdoc, I've really gotten into the observing stars to find and characterize planets. So that's radial velocity observations and the impact of host star activity on those observations in particular, and being able to disentangle things that are coming from a planet versus not coming from a planet. And so I've just, in the last year, started a survey of following up planets from TESS using Southern Telescope facilities. And we've been very purposeful about the design of this survey, trying to avoid bias, but it's kind of an always evolving thing. And so I'm happy to talk to other people about that or interested in knowing what other people are doing. I am very interested in equity and inclusion issues in astronomy, and this is something I try to think about as much as possible. And then also formal and informal STEM education. I've worked with, even Carnegie is not affiliated with university, but I've worked with a lot of students, undergraduates and graduate students. And then hobbies, I'm a huge Washington Nationals fan, and so I'm happy to watch baseball as long as the Washington Nationals are playing and I'm allowed to root for them. And then I also like running. I'm training for a marathon, so I need to keep doing that. And also recently found out that I can cycle outside, not just in a class in the dark. And I only fell once, so it was great. And then in terms of really what I need to work on here is finish a referee report and start writing a paper. But these are some things I'm interested in talking to people about. We had a paper for one test system that the planet orbital period is very close to slash the same, basically, as the stellar rotation period. And so someone can probably just answer this in one sentence, but how well can we know the stellar rotation period? What error does that have? How does it, Yeah, exactly. So I'd like to discuss this more because it's relevant for the following up of planets. There was an interesting talk at a meeting that I attended in Switzerland, the Extreme Precision RV4 meeting, where Ryan Cloutier presented some results suggesting that the sampling of your observations, radial velocity observations, can affect the mass that you pull out using a Gaussian process. And I don't think this was surprising to me, but it was just such a clear effect that if he even made like a sample data set, a fake planet with the same sampling, he doesn't, as the original data, he can't pull out the signal of the planet. So this kind of analysis of RVs is interesting to me. And then kind of my background interest is always testing the star to planet composition connection and how we can better constrain that.
Hi, I'm Adam Germain. I'm a postdoc here. So I would say my interests are broadly in hydrodynamics, transport, and turbulence in stars, all from very sort of theory perspective. But I'm also interested in things in planets, especially when planets start looking like stars, when you get tides or radiation, that sort of thing. I guess I forgot to put it on there. I'm also a MESA developer, so if you have questions, complaints, concerns, or suggestions, do let me know. Happy to see if we can make things that you want to happen. I guess socially, I'm very keen on hiking, and I'm local, so I know most of the hikes around, so do let me know if you're interested in that.
Thanks. Hi, I'm Jamie Tyre. I'm a Hubble Fellow at the University of Hawaii. And I'm pretty broadly interested in stars, stellar evolution, stellar rotation, with a focus on like subgiants and giant stars. But the thing I was interested in working on here is really looking at what we know in the models and what that means for our ability to understand, to measure planets, right? Because your planet radius and mass is only as certain as your star radius and mass. And we know that different isochrones will give you different masses. And we know that's worse for massive stars, but even you no longer want an order of magnitude mass for the star. You now want a 0.01 mass. And so with the, I want to look at what the constraints we have actually do for the masses that we can involve. I love this quote, the person with a watch knows what time it is. A person with two watches is never sure. And I'd say stellar isochrones are kind of at the same place as that. Oh, and if anybody wants to go rock climbing, there's apparently a rock climbing gym on campus that I'm very excited to go to.
Okay, thanks, Jamie.
All right, hi, I'm Natalie Hinkle. I'm currently at the Southwest Research Institute in San Antonio, which is kind of a weird half academic, half industry thing. They hired me to be the first exoplanet scientist and like start a group there, which is kind of interesting. So what I focus on is stellar abundances. So I like this figure that like Rory Barnes and Vicky Meadows put together because it shows like what makes a planet habitable. And so what I really focus on, and so like with, sorry, I'll start back. The black is sort of like the main points of it. The green are what we can directly measure. The orange are what we can get from models using some of the observations, and the red are purely theoretical. So the things that I really focus on are the chemical side of planetary habitability. So I put together a massive stellar abundance catalog. It's called the Hypatia Catalog. It's online. I have swag. I have Legos, so come and find me. And so I look at the composition of the stars in order to understand what's going on in the planet. So I feel like a lot of times when we talk about a planet being habitable, we really only focus on the physical side of the planet, like how close it is to the star, what does it sort of look like. But I'm trying to work with other people like geologists, biologists, astrobiologists, oceanographers, things like that, to understand how we can really go from the star to the planet to life. And so that really, I think, brings together sort of a more holistic planetary habitability definition. So like right now, I'm working on a paper with an oceanographer to look at phosphorus and stars and what does that mean about the planets, although we don't have a lot of these measurements, and then what does that entail for life. And the weird thing, just from our initial sort of analysis, is that the phosphorus that life needs is closer to what the phosphorus that we see in stars, like in terms of ratios, rather than the phosphorus in planets, which is just crazy. The other side of this is that I'm also trying to work with data scientists to help understand like a lot of the data that I'm working with. The Hypatia Catalog is a multidimensional database. I put together 171 data sets for 6,000 stars and 72 different elements, which is in total 270,000 abundance measurements. So there's a huge amount of data, and so I've really been trying to like sort of pick at this, but also to help go from the stars to the planets. So there's a lot going on here and a lot of interdisciplinary links that I'm totally fine saying to people like, I don't know what I'm doing, how to do this, so please help me get there and sort of learn the new techniques, learn the things to really do the planets in a whole way. So my sort of social side is that I like rock climbing. I wish I would have known. I would have brought my gear. I'm fine to rent it. Hiking and I'm terrible at yoga, but I like doing yoga. So like I'm happy to do bad yoga with other people. Just don't mind me if I fall over. It happens a lot. So yeah.
Hi everybody. So I decided to walk to the front so that you can actually see me. I'm Benny Zhang, local postdoc here, KITP. And so my main research interests are pretty broad. So one of them is to simulate the formation of dense star clusters. We're talking about star clusters that are upward of 1,000, 10,000 solar masses of stars. Fairly compact. And this is, details don't matter. The bottom line is, I am a theorist, I do simulation from molecular clouds to star clusters. So, besides that, I also focus a lot on radiation transport. So what we see from stars and planets. So is a very complicated radiation transport problem. And on top of that, I also model the dynamical and thermal impact of radiation, like heating of the gas, ionization of gas, radiation pressure on gas. So that is also some of my focus. And yeah, so basically my goal here is to look at the connection between star cluster formation and planets, and also try to push the envelope on predicting the observable from stars and planets, and that's my basic focus. For social events, I am a runner. I run a lot, and I'm also very interested in hiking. I think Santa Barbara is the best place on Earth, one of the best places on Earth to do hiking. So maybe we can find a joining group and then go hiking together. Thanks. Yes.
So I wrote there was this paper on the orientation of the spin axis of stars and clusters as measured by Kepler. So how can you relate that to your simulations? So do you find that stars are formed preferentially with the same rotation axis? Or is this more like a random distribution?
So in the theoretical side of this, it depends very much on how you put in as the initial condition for star cluster formation. For the dense clusters that I'm simulating, I would say we precisely know the actual kinematics of the gas that are forming dense clusters yet. We almost bringing us a lot of good observation and very new high angular resolution and observation of star cluster forming clouds. But at this point, we are not quite, I cannot say these are the initial condition for dense cluster formation. So the field right now, basic consensus is no one really is sure like what the initial condition is.
So you cannot make a prediction for what the spin orientation of the stars are in the fully formed cluster from your simulation?
Yeah, because it depends a lot on initial conditions and how you put in the turbulence for the turbulent molecular cloud and stuff like that.
But in a sense, wouldn't that already rule out the possibility of alignment in the sense that you really have to fine-tune?
Yeah. So if we, for example, set the zero parameter to be like 2, and just let the molecular cloud to be marginally bound, and of course we can. So because my simulation follow the formed star particles as like unresolved star clusters. So and if we look at the dynamics of the stars and the interaction of the star particles, we can have a handle on the dynamics of the star within the forming star cluster. So yeah, that's a possibility. Any more questions?
Okay,
thank you, Billy.
Next, Nicole. Okay. Hi everyone. My name is Miguel Lund. I'm an assistant professor at Stellar Astrophysics Center at Aarhus University in Denmark. And my main subject of work is astroseismology, here focusing on the more observer side of things, so both in terms of light curve preparation, but then also extraction of seismic parameters and everything basically that the modelers need to use to get their precisions. So that's a lot of what I do, and this is mainly of sun-like dwarfs, and also planetary hosts, both for the Kepler and K2 missions. And I'm moving more into applying this to cluster studies now, mainly for the K2 mission. And then as the other side of this, I'm also working heavily within the TESS mission. So I'm a chair of one of the groups within the astroseismic community, focusing on getting the detrending of the light curves done properly so that we can do all of our analysis. So that's also one of the things that I work on a lot these 3 weeks, actually finally getting our pipeline to run on these millions of light curves we have by now. And on the social side of things, I also like to hike, bike, and on occasion run, so I'll be happy to join some of those activities as well.
Yeah. Thanks, Nicole. One more? Yeah, over. Okay. I'm Aldo Fernandez. I work at the Institute of Space Sciences close to Barcelona in Bellaterra. So closely related to the activities at the KITP program, my interests are stellar evolution and
from the modeling point of view, and also access seismology, again, from the modeling point of view. So it's a complementary to what Mikkel has just said. The two main interests I have while being here is as a follow-up on what Pierre already mentioned, trying to use stellar binaries as test cases for improving stellar evolution. So what you can see there on the two plots on the left is results from paper by the PISA group, where they consider with a binary system that was used trying to constrain the overshooting. And you can see on the left two islands of solutions that are obtained when the masses are known to 0.1%. Once you relax that high precision and you move to 1%, you see the results on the right don't resemble at all what you have with a very precise measurement. So that shows the relevance of the precision that is required to trying to constrain the stellar physics from this. So that would be one of the topics here. And the other one is trying to improve the way I'm working on modeling subgiants, in particular because with tests, there will be many cases where this is needed. And that's an example from recent paper led by Daniel on TOI 197, where you see the observed oscillation pattern in gray symbols and the models and with the open symbols. So, but modeling subgiants is trickier than doing the same thing for main sequence stars because of the richness of the oscillation spectrum, in particular for dipole and also quadrupole modes. So that's my second topic for the meeting. Well, in terms of activities, I second what Mikkel said. Sometimes running. less and less with time.
Yeah, I think that was it. Lauren, do you want to resist?
Oh, sure.
You're our guy. Let's go.
So I'm Lauren Anderson. I'm actually at the other conference. I'm just here because I'm curious. But right now I'm trying to build a 3D dust map of the Milky Way using photometry plus Gaia parallaxes, and then using a Gaussian process as a model to do it. The biggest problem is that you have hundreds of millions of observations and GPs scale really poorly with numbers. So right now we're trying to work on building a GP that can work on at least like maybe tens of millions of observations. And then the other thing I recently became interested in is trying to constrain the distribution of mass in the Milky Way using stellar streams and maybe something about its accretion history. So recent work has shown that the infall of the LMC seems to perturb streams. You might actually be able to constrain something about the LMC's infall from modeling shapes of streams. And I know a lot of stuff about Gaia, so if you guys are curious about Gaia, do.
Fantastic. Okay. Well, Scott already talked in the last.
Mm-hmm. All right, hobbies.
Oh, hobbies.
So I also like to rock climb. The hiking around here is really great. I've been going up the coast. I've been here for like 5 weeks now or something. But going up to Big Sur is just incredible. And none of you guys will want to leave.
Scott, you want to introduce yourself real quick?
I'm Scott Tremaine. I don't know which program I'm with.
You're welcome to switch over to
Exoplanets, I guess one small project I'm doing now is there's been a number of claims recently that when you have multiple planets in a single system, they're in some loose sense more similar than you would expect them to be if they were kind of randomly chosen, as if, you know, one planet kind of knows something about how the other planet formed. I think the current formulations of that are maybe kind of oversimplified in the sense that they're testing against the model in which every star has exactly the same planet formation processes, where at the very least, the protoplanetary disks ought to be a one-parameter family, depending on the mass of the disk. And so I'm trying to see if you can make that statement precise enough to account for that, and if there are statistical tests that tell you anything about whether planets in a single system are somehow correlated in their radii or other properties.
Okay. All right. So that's everybody for today. Tomorrow we have our first science talk by Joanna. We also have a barbecue. Let's see, the morning talk's at 10:30.
Yeah. Was it? It's moved later.
Yeah, it's 10:30.
Well, so we thought there's an Astro 2020 webinar at 11 on Wednesday.
Yeah.
So I think 9:30. It's on 9:30 on Wednesday.
So our discussion on Wednesday morning, which will be more about finding common interests and forming working groups, that will be at 9:30. So we can share it with the Astro 2020. But yeah, I will send out another email later. I'm not sure if the damage is prepared for this point. Anyone would trust anything with saying this is good.
Well, they'll be here early.
Okay, on Wednesday, like I said, that's still open. This week, I think we'll try to meet and discuss working groups or anything else we want to accomplish on Wednesday, so think about that between now and then. Also, tomorrow night, we have our barbecue. That will all be organized through the Slack channel in terms of food and who's bringing chips and salsa and beer and burgers and whatever. So do that all there. Other things to discuss right now. Every day there's coffee at KITP and cookies right out here, except for Thursdays, because that's when the physics colloquium is. And Scott's giving one of those colloquia, and one of our participants is giving a colloquium later. So if there's no cookies on Thursday, don't get mad and email ours demanding cookies. You can go to the colloquia if you're interested, but of course you don't have to. We haven't organized this yet, we could think about some sort of Astro PH or archive discussion on one day or more per week. Again, that's something I think can decide on Wednesday.
Yeah, but our nominal slots are all in the morning, at least for the next few weeks, I think. That's just to accommodate the other programs that have rooms booked. Because the other thing I would say is that take a look at the program. Apart from what's happening in our program, there are other events going on. The link is on the Slack channel. It shows you the entire, and it's also posted everywhere. So there are other things going on.
Does somebody local want to organize a hike for the weekend? Because it sounds like you get at least half a dozen people.
Sure. Good. Yeah, that'd be great. So there's a channel on Slack. Someone can post it there, so we can sign up. Sorry?
Hashtag hiking.
Yes, that's right. I think that'd be the most efficient way. That's a good idea. Yeah, there were several hikers, rock climbers, only two surfers. I don't think about that. Okay, I think there's cookies now.
Yeah.
Yes.